Gobble Gobble. We'll discuss this and more on this special pre-Thanksgiving edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty, plus Jack Butler. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors are Fire, Tommy John, and Acton Unwind. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. And before I do anything else, let me share a message from our friends at Fire. Do you know only 1 in 3 Americans believe we can fully exercise our free speech rights? That's why Fire is stepping up to protect freedom of expression for all Americans, no matter where you're from or what you believe. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or Fire, knows free speech makes free people. Fire will always be a principled, nonpartisan, nonprofit defender of your rights. Join the fight for free speech at www.thefire.org, www.thefire.org. Please check it out. Our friends at Fire do really important work that's just becoming more important than ever, unfortunately. So, MBD, we have Mike Pence is out with his book. It's pretty harsh on Donald Trump after the post-election shenanigans, to put it mildly, and the effort to push Pence into unilaterally changing the electoral vote count, which Pence, to his great credit, resisted. But I listened to Pence on Meet the Press last weekend, you know, half an hour, 45-minute interview with Pence, and he's still engaged in this kind of dance. First of all, with relation to the post-election episode and January 6th, he really blames it on bad lawyering. So there's a little bit of a only if the czar knew aspect to it, where, you know, of course Trump's not going to have the best lawyers helping him to overturn an election, right? Because the good lawyer said, no, sir, you can't do this. So then he brings in the Sidney Powells and the rest of them. And that's on Trump more than it's on Sidney Powell and the rest of them. And, you know, Pence refers constantly to the Trump-Pence administration, which is understandable if you want to take credit for the successes of an administration. But, you know, his case ultimately has to be that Trump failed in important respects and let us down. So the Trump-Pence stuff sort of emphasizes how they were joined at the hip. So it just goes to how Pence, I've known him for years, I have a high degree of admiration for him, is in a really tricky spot in terms of 2024 and the case he wants to make. And I do assume that he might be the guy I'm most certain is going to run, besides Trump, who's obviously already in.
Yeah, I think it's just a mistake. I think he's kind of misread where he should be in relation to the field or the electorate or the former president. I mean, it reminds me of, I was there when John Huntsman made his disastrous 2012 announcement, and it was like, oh, this guy's been out of the country for 4 years and he doesn't realize that Republicans hate Obama. Like, because he's promising, I'm going to have a respectful conversation with my former boss, when he should have been saying, I was on the inside and it was terrible.
Yeah. Gosh, thanks for reminding me of the John Huntsman campaign.
but the
wherever, I don't know where it was, in Iowa or New Hampshire, but, you know, all his very attractive daughters were wearing kind of similar kind of plaid shirts, and they're you know, elite journalists there who are going to write their glossy profiles, even though it was clear it was going absolutely nowhere.
But it reminds me of just a misfire right out of the gun. And you know, Pence would have to, unfortunately, Pence is driven into this error by his high character, which is he took on voluntarily the role of vice president under Donald Trump. And he served very loyally in almost a biblical sense of, like, I am not going to make the job of my boss any harder than it has to be. I'm not going to criticize him out of turn. I'm going to take my subordinate position very seriously until the end. And now he refuses to kind of, you know, tell the whole truth, which was the administration was in chaos from day one. I saw this man maladministrate the White House and therefore the country. That's what he would have to say, to be honest, but in a way it would be betraying. It would make his 4 years of quiet seem strange in reverse. So it's an impossible role.
So another former official who is not in the same tricky position, Jack, because he's not running in 2024, but one of my favorites, Bill Barr, is just taking out the shotgun and is blast after blast directed Trump's way in speeches, in interviews, in a piece for Barry Weiss's website, Common Sense, where he just makes the case, you know, there are positive attributes to Trump, you know, that you could squint the right way and certainly see them in 2016. But over time, it was clear that the downsides outweighed the positives, and we paid the price for that at the end. And we're going to have paid the price electorally here in the Georgia special elections and now in the midterms, and we're going to pay it again unless we move on.
Yeah, Bill Barr is doing, I think, pretty much exactly the right thing here. He has a great deal of credibility from his time in the Trump administration. He did various things that Trump and people who supported Trump and people who didn't support Trump liked in his position as Attorney General. And yeah, I mean, this is exactly the kind of person you think would need to be the messenger for this message. And it has, to me, been revealing that because Barr has been saying these things, the predictable cast of characters have now turned on Barr after previously been supporting him. To me, that suggests that their main criterion is sort of fealty to Trump and what is in Trump's interest. Because Barr, again, his time in that position was solid, and he repeatedly gave reasons to respect and admire his tenure returning to that old post. And I guess there's an instructive contrast with Pence, at least so far in the terms of their public conduct, because as Michael said, Pence is circumscribed or constrained in his ability to say what he needs to say. But I will actually dissent slightly from the Michael's assessment of Pence, which he's a lot right here. But I think that, I mean, there's no way, we might get into this later, there's no way that a Pence presidential run will succeed. It seems unlikely to me, but I think that just having him on a debate stage and forcing these tensions to be out in the open could end up being more productive than we might think. And it'll certainly attract Trump's attention if Pence is there saying even in discreetly critical things. So, I mean, these are varying approaches for how to deal with the looming specter of Trump. Barr has an easier job of it, given his stature and the position he had. But Pence might have a role to play in here, too. It all just remains to be seen.
So, Charlie, you, as we referred to in the editor's pick section of our last episode, you've written a piece, MBD's piled in and written a similar piece. Let's not get in this 2016 situation where we have an enormous number of candidates who dilute and split all the non-Trump vote or anti-Trump vote and create a situation where he wins with the plurality again.
I think there's a couple of reasons not to want an enormous Republican field. And one of them is that it will help Trump, as it did last time. Trump in 2015-16 was garnering about 35% of the vote, but there were so many other candidates that he prevailed. That's a problem, and it's a problem that will be made worse in 2024 if 16, 17, or 20 people run. And ironically, will be made primarily by people who think they're running to get rid of Trump. The other reason, though, is that there simply aren't 15, 17, 20 viable Republican candidates. Forget Trump for a moment. I cannot sit in my house and decide who runs. It isn't up to me. But I am astute enough to know, for example, that Larry Hogan is not going to be the Republican nominee in 2024. I don't know who's telling him otherwise. I don't know what's going on in his mind. But that is about as close to an immutable fact as any prediction could possibly be. I think it is highly unlikely that Mike Pompeo is going to be the Republican nominee in 2024. I think it is highly unlikely that Asa Hutchinson is going to be the Republican nominee in 2024. There are only a few people who are going to be able to bridge the two wings of the party. And this is where we have to inject Trump back in, and who are going to be able to bring over the people who are disappointed that the nominee in 2024 is not Donald Trump. There is, I think, a handful of legitimate justifications for running for president. Perhaps you are incredibly knowledgeable in an area that is of great salience in our era. Perhaps you are the best representative of your wing of the party. Perhaps you're just extraordinarily charismatic, although if you are, you'll know it. You won't be told it by a political consultant. How many people could we filter through those descriptions and place on a GOP debate stage? 5? 6? Not 20. So I think that it is about time that people on the right, and it's not going to carry too much weight coming from me, a writer, it's going to carry a lot more weight coming from activists and primary voters and the people who will make this decision. Tell Republicans, don't run. Hey, don't run. Hey, Larry Hogan, don't run. Hey, Mike Pompeo, don't run. Hey, Asa Hutchinson, don't run. Don't bother. I know your political consultant wants you to run. He wants a new Lamborghini, but there is no demand for you. You are not in the conversation. And you know, if they do, we might get a much more meaningful primary season. But also, yes, we might get a primary season in which we don't split the vote 15 different ways and allow Donald Trump to push through once again and lose the next election.
So, MBD, this is where I disagree with you guys. Larry Hogan, yeah, Larry Hogan shouldn't run. But I do think we need to be careful about putting our, and I know this is not what you guys are saying, but we do need to resist the temptation to put all our eggs in the Ron DeSantis basket. Although he looks, you know, really strong right now, we need to see how he runs. You know, we need to see him eating pork chop on a stick at the Iowa State Fair and mingling with people around the butter cow and all that sort of stuff. And so where I would definitely agree with your guys' assessment is on the back end. Before Iowa, if you're not viable, if you're only taking 5%, get out. I mean, it will really be imperative to get out. But I don't mind having a moderately large field. People shouldn't be running to get cable contracts. People shouldn't be running just to make a point, knowing they have zero chance to run. But we do need more candidates than just Trump DeSantis initially, because there is some chance, as we've talked about before, this thing could bounce in a different way. And maybe Trump's weaker than we think. Maybe DeSantis is weaker than we think.
Just to be clear, I'm in no way suggesting that we ought to put all of our eggs in the DeSantis basket. As I've written before, I don't know if he will turn out to be viable. We don't know what his views are on national topics. We don't know if he can sustain the jump from the state level to the federal level. Mm-hmm. We don't know what will happen once Trump goes after him. We don't know what will happen once he meets voters. But I think having 5 or 6 people for whom there is real demand, mm-hmm. people who have an existing or a potential source of support within the party, is a great idea. I think having 15 to 20 people, most of whom have no obvious source of support or reason to run beyond that they would like to be president, it's a terrible mm-hmm. idea.
So like a Youngkin's on the right side of your line, but a Larry Hogan. Obviously.
And look, I don't necessarily think that he would set the world alight, but I can see justifications for example, Greg Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
governor of a major state. I can see a justification for Tim Scott. I can't see a demand-side argument for Larry Hogan or Asa Hutchinson or Mike Pompeo or, you know, a lot of the people who are going to say that they're going to prey on it in Iowa over the next few months. And I think that these people should be honest with themselves about that, that this is not a completely open field. This is not a Republican Party that doesn't know who it likes or what it wants to achieve, where you could have someone who just comes out from the shadows in the wings and runs up to the top. That's not this year.
I'm almost, can I argue for almost putting all your eggs in the DeSantis basket? Because, intuitively, what you guys said makes perfect sense. Don't put all your eggs in his basket. But Donald Trump potentially drove out millions of people from their Republican affiliation when he ran for the president and won. And we've seen that in the last three elections. Ron DeSantis has drawn in perhaps a similar amount into the Republican Party based on how he handled COVID. And I see this all throughout my extended family and elsewhere, that people who hated the lockdowns, who hated the idea of vaccine mandates or whatever, suddenly liked Ron DeSantis. And this is the reason they were drawn away from their previous affiliation with the Democrats. That's even people like Tulsi Gabbard is one of those people. And Ron DeSantis is also someone that most Trump supporters also like. And it's just like, this is a golden goose. Right now, and I'm not ready to put him near Chris Christie or other arsonists, you know, like in the meantime. I'm sorry. I think, and I'm making that as almost like a devil's argument, but I don't think we appreciate how much Ron DeSantis changed America and even helped to change our partisan alignments in the last 3 years.
May I summon another demon against your devil's argument?
Sure.
It would be this, that the very fact of, I should preface this by saying this all gets really stupid when you try to game this out like 12 steps in advance, but the argument would go something like this. Basically, if the very fact that people like us squishes at National Review are already saying like, get on the DeSantis train, is itself going to be interpreted as evidence that, oh, DeSantis is just a return to the pre-2016 status quo, and that's why he's having all of these meetings with donors,
and he's really cognizant of that risk, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I you all know I have been, and I say it here in public too. I am concerned about everyone. I'm concerned that if everyone gets behind DeSantis, that it'll be interpreted as like a restoration and repudiation of Trump, and then that will turn off a sizable amount of voters who are excited by Trump and whom Republicans need to retain in future elections.
Yeah, sorry, Jack, I cut you off.
No, I was done.
Okay, all right.
You know, one thing that we must do, and it does not have to be Ron DeSantis, because we're so early in the primary season, for all the reasons that we just outlined, it would be premature to anoint Ron DeSantis as the nominee for the non-Trump faction. But one thing we do have to do is encourage Republican primary voters to find the person that they like the most and that they think is viable and coalesce around him or her early. And I think that is a strategic decision that is going to be really important within these primaries. Of course, you can't tell people what to do. You shouldn't. But if it turns out that Ron DeSantis is a dud and Greg Abbott is lighting the world on fire, I think the people who prefer the other non-Trump candidate need to put that behind them and say, he's my guy. And I think the other candidates need to drop out early, because if they don't, we know what's going to happen.
Yeah. So on the other hand, I'm not all our eggs in DeSantis basket guy, but I mean, he's the strongest any potential presidential candidate has been in his position since George Bush, after George Bush won a whopping landslide reelection in Texas, had everyone knocking on his door, had huge donor support, had support among the chattering class or really important elements of it. And DeSantis is in that position. Now it's just, it's a huge step up from the state stage to the national stage and running a multi-state primary campaign. And we have to see where it goes. But also, as Dan McLaughlin's pointed out, he's in the George W. Bush perfectly positioned to be the turn the page guy. You know, in 98, it was after the meltdown of Newt Gingrich. And this time around, it would be after the disappointment of the midterms and various other Trump failures. So exit question before we get to Thanksgiving stuff to you, Jack Butler. Over the last 2 weeks since the midterms, you are more optimistic about the prospects of the Republican Party, more pessimistic, or just the same?
I would say unchanged, just the same. Too soon to tell. As the famous description of the results of the French Revolution, which someone told me was actually about the 68 French Revolution, not the 89 French Revolution when the Chinese premier said this to Nixon. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, that would make it, that would put it in a little more context, because that would be only, what, like 10 or maybe even like 5 years later, something like that.
It almost ruins it.
I know. I hope I haven't ruined this for everyone. But I don't know if that's true, but this is what I read this somewhere recently. But anyway, too soon to tell, whatever this soon is.
Too soon to tell, too good to check.
Right, exactly. That's the way that I live my life.
So we have a cautious, I would have a month ago scorned such caution on the part of Jack, but it served him well in his Senate predictions, right? So Charlie Cook, more optimistic, pessimistic, the same?
I'm more optimistic.
Because of what it's done to Trump and what happened with DeSantis?
Yes. I'm disappointed by the results because I think you build Senate majorities over decades. And the consequences of dropping down to 49, which I believe the Republicans are going to stay at, will be felt for years. But I suppose in my incorrect assumptions as to where the midterms were going, I had never countenanced the idea that they could damage, perhaps mortally, Donald Trump standing within the party. And now I think that that is a possibility. So I am more optimistic having emerged from my pessimism.
MBD.
So I'm pessimistic. I've been stalked by and haunted by the thought that in the right coalition now, church-going people, churchy people, are play the parallel role that the university professors and the media plays in the Democratic Party. That we are foisting on a coalition in which we are a minority of people values which actually the majority don't share. You know, and I think I worry that that was in evidence in the way Dobbs put it out. And I'm really worried, actually, it's also in evidence on the trans issue. I just see more resistance from that the higher up the income ladder you go and the more churchy you go. And really only about 15% of Americans go to church regularly. So I'm a little concerned about the future of the right when it's more secularized. Secularized right has some pretty ugly temptations.
That's worked out well in the past.
Yeah.
All right. So that's
a gloomy note.
That's a concerning answer. It goes a little deeper than my just superficial take here, where I agree with Charlie. We're both equally superficial, Charlie. Just the prospects of the party. You know, it was really depressing what happened in the midterms, but it has opened up this vista where there's the possibility of moving beyond Trump, which is really important in all sorts of ways. So I am now slightly more optimistic with that. Let's pause. Speaking of optimism, let's go to Tommy John. Getting stuck in Black Friday crowds, super uncomfortable. Shopping Tommy John's Black Friday sale from your couch, super duper comfortable. When you give your loved ones Tommy John, they're that much more comfortable so they can do everything better. Shop Tommy John's Black Friday sale right now and give the gift of comfort to everyone on your list, including yourself, with brand new Tommy John underwear, loungewear, and pajamas with over 18 million pairs sold. Giving Tommy John has become a holiday tradition. 97% of women and men love getting a gift from Tommy John. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. Celebrate softness season with the gift of Tommy John underwear, loungewear, and pajamas. Every gift is backed by Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Black Friday sale going on right now and get 30% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/editors. 30% off everything now at TommyJohn.com/editors. That's TommyJohn.com/editors. See the site for details. So, MBD, we're going to pre-celebrate Thanksgiving in true Editors Podcast style with a spate of exit questions. What better way to mark the coming holiday? So, MBD, simple yes or no question. Thanksgiving is a lie, yes or no, and why or why not?
It's not a lie. No, Thanksgiving is Thanksgiving is true because, one, it's a tradition in this country for more than a century now, and a tradition that dates all the way back to our founding years. Although it's evolved quite a lot from the National Day of Humiliation that John Adams proposed. but it is natural for humans, especially in a country,
John Adams,
in a country that depends, as ours does, and basically almost every other country does, on agriculture for its life, basically anywhere that's not Singapore, you know, you should have a moment of thanks in the fall or as you head into the winter after the harvest for whatever bounty the land has given up to provide for you for the rest of the year. So it's totally natural, and and it's just a lovely holiday. The way it's developed in America to be just a big feastal meal with everyone bringing their own peculiar and personal thanks to the table is really special. And I think everyone that's not an American in my family envies it.
So, Jack, that's an eloquent defense of Thanksgiving. But we know the critique. You go back to the supposed first Thanksgiving. It wasn't really a Thanksgiving. They just would have been, you know, praying all day if it was a true Thanksgiving in that time period. They wouldn't have been eating. They weren't really called pilgrims. They didn't wear dour clothes. And by the way, this friendliness with the Indians, well, we all know how that turned out. So please don't talk to us of your supposed Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I mean, these arguments remind me of the people who are nitpickers about movies and just prevent people from ever enjoying them. You know, there's a YouTube account called Cinema Sins. Basically, within our elite institutions, there's now like a giant YouTube account called America Sins, and it's just constantly pointing out all the things that are wrong with America. But that's not a fun way to live, and it just helps explain why so many of the people within these institutions are miserable all the time. And I think that actually, when it comes down to it, I would suspect that a lot of these people are actually just going to celebrate Thanksgiving in the way that basically everyone else does. They're not going to be really thinking about these colonialist critiques or these parsing of a historical record. They're probably going to have a Thanksgiving meal. Many of them might watch a football game. They're going to do these things that have become an ingrained part of our national culture, and a welcome one. And to answer your question directly about whether Thanksgiving is a lie, it will be until our first president, until we get a president who finally just executes the turkeys instead of pardoning them. no,
falsity of the turkey pardons. Charlie Cook.
I see this question in the same way I see, say, marriage. There are people who are keen to tell you, not incorrectly, that back in the day, marriage was deeply unequal. People married each other for property or status, and women were chattels. There are people who will say the wedding ring on your finger is a sign of bondage, not of enduring love. And I don't care, because that's not what it is now. And that's not what mine is. So even if it's true that the origin story of Thanksgiving represents a myth or has been altered or sanitized or euphemized, I don't think that in any way undermines what Thanksgiving has evolved to be in American culture today. And what it has evolved to be in American culture today is the best holiday of the year and a great opportunity for reflection and gratitude and family. And so much as Jack's movie spoiling fiends run around talking about this or that, I think it's worth ignoring.
Yeah, I take all that. I think it's very well said. And, you know, key aspects of this story are correct. I mean, they might have actually eaten turkey. We don't know. There was a lot of turkey around, and their descriptions of hunting for turkey. Squanto played a really important role. Squanto's story is a complicated and ultimately a sad one, but they wouldn't have made it without him. This was a friendly gathering with Indians. It was a peace that lasted with the relevant tribe for like 50 years. And even putting that all that aside, if we didn't have a day to kind of stop, to express gratitude, to marvel at the abundance of this country, to spend time with family and friends with really no other agenda and nothing on the table rather than a lot of food, we'd have to invent such a day. So no, Thanksgiving is not a lie. With that, let me pause and do a quick read from our friends at Act and Unwind. There's news and information constantly coming at us from all sides. With this barrage of information, it's difficult to stay up to speed with everything that's happening in the world. Who can you trust to explain what's going on from a perspective that values both faith and freedom? That's where Act and Unwind comes in. Just so there's no other organization that brings you a perspective that values faith, liberty, and free enterprise like the Acton Institute, there's no other podcast that tackles the issues of the day in quite the same way as Act and Unwind. Every Monday, you'll hear from host Eric Cohn and experts from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty as they take you through the news of the week in a roundtable conversation, breaking down the issues and the stories that matter, and demonstrating the compatibility of faith, liberty, and free economic activity in a way that's clear, concise, and entertaining. Whether it's about politics, religion, or culture, you'll get Acton's unique outlook on the world, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it promotes a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Acton Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or just search Acton Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Acton Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. That's acton.org/NR to subscribe to the Acton Unwind podcast. Charlie Cook, another question to you. If Thanksgiving weren't so associated with football, how would this affect your enjoyment of the holiday? 0% wouldn't matter. Come on, get real. It's about expressing gratitude, spending time with family, whether football is on the TV or not, or 100%, it would fundamentally blight your experience of Thanksgiving.
Well, I mean, it would diminish my experience solely in the sense that I love football, and it's a great opportunity to watch football with my family. But if it went away, I wouldn't say it would blight Thanksgiving.
I'm not sure we get an honest answer from Charlie, but that's what we got, MBD, from Charlie. Not fundamentally blight, diminish a little bit. Where are you?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we find each other's company and conversation a little bit more engaging than the Detroit Lions. I don't know why I don't know why I should forsake my family for the Detroit Lions.
On this in the background
day when I have them.
Winding down.
We just lost the Detroit market on this podcast.
Sorry. Listen, for some people, I'm sure the Detroit Lions is how they bond with their family. It's just not how I bond with mine.
Jack Butler.
Well, my views about football and most spectator sports generally are known. I'm a fan of their social utility, but I'm not. Don't partake in them and watching them that much. But I think it would somewhat hamper the Thanksgiving atmosphere if there weren't a football game happening so that it could be on again in the background. Sorry. But people do, while they're eating, they watch it and talk idly about how whichever team is playing is doing that year. I have nothing to contribute to such conversations almost ever. But I'm glad that there are people in my family who do.
What if there's just a Lord of the Rings marathon on Thanksgiving?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't want that either. That would be like that's a fully engaging experience. I can't. That can't just happen.
All right. So I'm gonna be the only one who's gonna get a percentage answer. 30%. I think it's an important part of the holiday. Yes, mostly background, but you know, not just at night. You got to have every single game on, and you kind of dip in and out. Not while you're eating, but kind of the pre-eating and post-eating and the drinking. You want to be able to sit down on the couch and watch some football and converse with family and friends as well. But it's really, I wrote a column about this week. It's a deep association. I mean, the first college game, Yale-Princeton on Thanksgiving Day, I don't know, it might have been, it's within, you know, a decade maybe of Lincoln's first national Thanksgiving proclamation. It becomes a huge sensation. You have countless high schools around the country that have Thanksgiving Day rivalries that go back more than 100 years, even though just the Lions, who were disparaged by MBD, you know, since 1934, with only an interruption for World War II. I mean, it's an important tradition, and it's something I really do enjoy about the day. It doesn't, you know, wouldn't ruin Thanksgiving without it, but it's I think it's
you gave the same answer as me and said that mine wasn't a fully honest answer.
Now, can I ask which do you enjoy more, the Thanksgiving Day games or the rivalry college football games that happen on the following Saturday?
Which do I enjoy more?
Yes.
The rivalry college football games. They are more meaningful than just the Lions versus the Bears or whatever.
Although this year it's going to be Cowboys Giants, which will be a good game, and especially for me because not me, I'm a Jaguars fan, but my whole family's Giants fans, so that should be raucous.
So two 7-3 NFC East teams. So Charlie Cook, another one for you first. Do you prefer to cook or be cooked for?
Be cooked for, without a shadow of a doubt, because I'm not a very good cook. I will try. I don't have the magic in my fingers, so I'd much rather be cooked for.
I knew that's what your answer was going to be, but MBD, I'm not sure where MBD is going to come down on this.
Oh, I'd rather cook, especially the turkey. I produce a tasty, delicious,
juicy
Thanksgiving turkey that changes people's minds about turkey.
Wow, like what's your trick? A lot of butter?
You think he's going to reveal his trick?
No, there's a lot of butter. It's not even a trick. It's just my mother found the roasted rosemary turkey recipe from Southern Living in 1999. And that recipe is a killer. And it's rather straightforward, but every year I've been able to make it, I've been able to change someone's mind about Thanksgiving turkey.
Stuff a lot of rosemary in there?
A lot of rosemary, but also like a lot of citrus, a lot of lemon and onion in the cavity.
Yeah, it's paprika for the juiciness.
Paprika on the bird, and yeah, cheesecloth over it to keep the breast cool. One that's doused in butter, white Zinfandel, and orange juice.
So Sarah, let's get someone who's an authority on how to really have a family celebration. The shitties are I envy the shitties, all the shitties family tradition. So what's the turkey tradition in the shitty household?
What do you think I'm gonna say, Charlie?
Isn't it your family that sprays champagne all over the turkey?
Yeah, I should have remembered.
Yes, alcohol is involved. Though I'm not sure. My mom changes up sometimes. I think I saw her buy champagne, so I'm pretty sure we're using champagne again this year, and we stuffed the cavity with apples and champagne, and then there's butter. I think we tuck butter under the skin as well. We shall see.
Nice. So you guys probably are like so concerned with spending time together and singing songs and conversing meaningfully, probably don't even have the TV on.
You would be very correct. I have never watched a Thanksgiving football game, Thanksgiving Day football game before.
All right.
Well, thanks, Sarah, for making sure that I wasn't the least.
You watch Thanksgiving Running or something, Jack?
Oh, I do. No, I don't watch it. I do it every year.
So Jack, I imagine you prefer to be cooked for?
I do, although I will say there is something satisfying about actually making something that satisfies other people. Not that I do it very often on Thanksgiving, and nor am I trusted to do it, and rightly so. So I'm fine with being cooked for.
So I don't think I can really answer this question. I mean, it's a tie. I mean, there's a lot to be said. Just a short drive to someone else's house where you get showered with a traditional lovely Thanksgiving meal. But then there's also something really satisfying as well as making something that other people enjoy, which I did last year. And by the end of the day, my feet were sore. You know, I stood up for so long chopping and washing dishes. I mean, the dishes from a big meal like that are just a massive task to deal with in and of themselves. So I'm gonna push on this one. I can't answer. They both have their own satisfactions. Jack Butler, we're closing in on the end of this podcast. Just two questions left. Your favorite Thanksgiving tradition?
Oh, it has to be over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house I go. And actually, we don't go to my grandmother's house anymore as she has passed away. But your memory about her having sore feet reminded me of one of my favorite memories of her. She was the maestro of Thanksgiving. It couldn't happen without her. She was instrumental in all of the preparations. And one year, I think in one of the last years of her life, I remember seeing her at the end of all of this and just sitting down, resting her very sore feet and other parts of her body, and just asking for a glass of wine and taking a deep breath and relaxing and knowing that she had been instrumental in preparing all of these dinner celebrations for my dad's side of the family. And we've continued this tradition in her absence. We'll always find a way to do it because this is a testament to her, the legacy and the family that she brought into the world, that we find new ways to express the same forms that she bequeathed to us. So thanks to her.
MBD.
Just the toast before dinner, usually where we remember and pray for everyone that came before us.
Yeah. Very, very nice. Charlie Cook.
I think I've ever thought about that before. I like the moment after dinner when everyone's full and contented and quiet and has a glass of wine and the football's on.
Yep. Sarah Shitty.
Ooh. My family plays a very raucous game of Tripoli, or actually multiple games of Tripoli, sometime in the evening. And as we've gotten older, we've had glasses of wine that go with it. And we've been using our own money recently, which has made it a lot more fun. And yeah, we have a good time.
So my favorite tradition, unfortunately, is one that's passed. I'm going to get verklempt here, possibly. But my dad used to make chocolate mousse that was just absolutely wonderful, the best mousse I'd ever had. He was a chocoholic, took great care with things he really cared about, a lot of things he didn't care about. But the things he did, he really poured himself fully into. And I tried to make a chocolate mousse myself a year or two ago, and it was okay, but it did not remotely measure up. So it's best just to kind of, I think, treasure this past memory. Final exit question to you, Jack Butler. First, your favorite part of the Thanksgiving meal?
Oh, goodness. If any friends or family of mine are listening to this podcast, they will already know my answer. It's the bread. I have been known for I've been known for consuming just obscene amounts of bread.
Bread?
From my earliest days. Yes, it's the bread. Man on Thanksgiving can live on bread alone. And ideally, as was mentioned earlier, this bread is enticed not by any sort of sauce or butter or anything, but merely by the empty stomach generated by a early morning Thanksgiving run or race. So yes, it's the bread. And if I had said anything else, then dozens of people would have accused me of lying, because That is what I eat every Thanksgiving.
You're closer than the rest of us to being a monk. You know that? Like Sarah Schutte's putting champagne all over her food, and Rich is eating chocolate mousse, and Michael's, wow, that whole recipe sounded delicious. And you're going for a run in the morning and then eating bread.
Yeah, well, look, you can make, you could make it. There's all sorts of wonderful ways to prepare bread in roll form and loaf form. Like it's all delicious and it's understated. There's a reason it's been a mainstay of the human diet for a long time. Although some people have complicated feelings about that given our hunter gatherer past. But anyway, yes, it's the bread.
The key though should be not to eat the stuff just to fill you up before you get to the main event. I have Mediterranean derived family members who serve, you know, a huge plate of pasta before you get to the traditional meal. So I always try to politely pick on that and wait.
Please.
Certainly loading up on bread, I just don't get. But Charlie Cook, your favorite part of the meal?
Well, I say this every year when we do this, it's my wife's stuffing mm-hmm. with sausage. Mm-hmm.
It has a nice zest.
It is delicious. In fact, I'm now going to get emails I get every year asking for the recipe. So if you do want to email me and ask for the recipe, I check with my wife and it's fine. She didn't come up with it, so it's not even as if it's giving away a great secret. I will send it to you.
MBD.
I'll say my wife's pumpkin cheesecake, which is an annual feature.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So it's the stuffing. I love stuffing. Doesn't matter. I would love Charlie's wife's stuffing, I'm sure. I love stuffing, just Pepperidge Farm out of a box. So stuffing and gravy, just lots of gravy on everything. So, wow, that's it for us. This was really enjoyable.
I am so hungry.
Yeah, I know. Get him some bread. Run out and eat some bread right away.
Give me some bread, stat.
So you've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thanks to Charlie. Thanks to MBD. And thanks to Jackie B. Thanks to Fire, Tommy John, and Acton Unwind. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We are the editors. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, everyone.